welcome to the Layer 8 Podcast Season 3, culminating with the Layer 8 Conference on Saturday, October 8th in Providence, Rhode Island. This season, we'll have conversations with social engineers and OSINT investigators who will tell their stories. We hope you enjoy them.
Welcome to another episode of the Layer 8 Podcast. We have an exciting guest for you tonight. We have Dallin McClellan with us. Welcome, Dallin.
Hi, thank you.
For the benefit of our listeners, could you tell them a little bit about who you are?
Yeah, sure. So I am a pen tester with NetSpy. I focus primarily on application pen testing, but also social engineering. I am the head of the on-site social engineering service line for NetSpy. Yeah, so I do a lot of the actually breaking into buildings, talking to people, the sort of in-person side of social engineering stuff. And it is my favorite part of my job. I love it.
And I love to hear that you also do like web application penetration testing, because I think when people are really interested in social engineering, they're looking for a job where that's all that they do. And I think a lot of times the advice that I give, I don't know if you also get asked the same types of things. How do I get a job where I get to do the physical break in social engineering? And I'm like, well, you probably just need to get a job as a penetration tester. So maybe you'll want to kind of get a little bit up on things like web application testing, network testing. Is that typical advice that you give as well?
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely. If this is something somebody wants to do as their job, that is the very first prerequisite, is learn the technical skills of penetration testing. It's not only just the way the industry is, most physical on-site tests are going to include some element of technical pen testing as well. Eventually, you're going to be plugging a laptop into a LAN port. You're going to be dropping a USB drive somewhere. You're going to be taking that attack into the technical realm at some point most of the time. And so you need to have those skills as well and be ready to execute on that.
Well, this podcast has never been about web application pen testing, so we're not really going to describe that. The reason that you're here is to talk a little bit about social engineering. And one of the things that caught my eye was a blog post on the NetSpy website. And if anybody wants to go check it out, you can find the Not Your Average Bug Bounty, how an email, a shirt, and a sticker compromised a high security data center. So we might talk a little bit more about that. And if people, after listening to this episode, go back and read it, you'll probably hear some of the same types of things. Dallin, one of the things that I like to ask people about when they're doing physical on-site penetration tests is, what is the value of OSINT and doing all of your checking and investigating beforehand, before you even get to the location?
Yeah. So, I mean, OSINT is the second part of any good pen test. The first part is defining your scope, is making sure that you know exactly where you're going and what you're doing. But once you've got that sorted out, OSINT is incredibly important, because that is the foundation that the rest of the test is built on. You know, in order to break into a high security building, you need a pretext. You need some reason for who you are pretending to be, and why you need access to this place that you don't currently have access to. And OSINT is the research that helps you build that pretext. Yeah, the more OSINT that you can do, the deeper OSINT you can do, the more likely you are to be able to craft a believable pretext that will get you through that front door, that will, you know, get you those kind of high severity findings that will actually be valuable to the customers.
Is the OSINT that you do for a physical penetration test the same type of OSINT where you might be Googling and looking up people's social media? Or does the investigation have to wait until you're actually on site and you start driving around the building? How do those two parts of the investigation come into play?
Yeah. So, I mean, the OSINT begins way before I get on an airplane or in a car. Typically, we want 2 to 3 weeks worth of time in advance to learn as much as we can about the company, about their culture, about their people. there's really no such thing as valueless information when it comes to OSINT. There is, you know, high value information and low value information, but anything that you learn can possibly be helpful. So the more time and effort and energy you have to spend on that, the better. In the particular case of this blog post, due to, you know, some contractual issues and just scoping, we didn't have as much time as we would have liked for that. So that was kind of an interesting wrinkle with this test. But in a more standard traditional test, yeah, we would have spent quite a bit of time before we had ever set foot on the ground.
Yeah, I think there was one of the things that stood out in there. It might have only been a week or so that you had to prepare for that.
Yeah.
And I know one of the things that you said that the client did for you was they did give you some information that would have been findable online,
right?
Which makes perfect sense to me. And I'm sure you've also come across these types of clients who will tell you, well, you're a hacker. Can't you figure it out? I'm not giving you any kind of information. To which my answer is usually like, yes, I can, but I don't have unlimited full time to find that. And I don't think you want to pay me for that kind of unlimited time.
Right.
So would you agree or have any kind of other opinions on the amount of help that you can ask for from a client is probably inverse to the amount of time that you have. So if you don't have too much time, it's perfectly cool to ask for more help. Whereas if they're giving you weeks and weeks or months of time, maybe then you will want to ask a little bit less.
Yeah, exactly. And that was one of the big takeaways for us on this test is, in traditional sort of technical pen testing, you have the concept of a black box test versus a white box test, where in a black box, you know nothing about the thing you're trying to break into. You just have to find some way to interact with it and break it. A white box test, the company gives you their source code. They give you whatever that you need in order to be the most efficient with the limited amount of time that you have to work on this. So we decided to treat this test like a white box test, essentially, that, if the question is, could someone sit outside your building for months at a time with a telephoto lens and take photos of every single vendor that comes in and out for months? Yes, they could. And there's absolutely nothing you could do to stop them from doing that. So let's just take that for granted. Let's just assume you have, this is a high security location with really valuable information. Let's just make the assumption that there is somebody out there with that kind of time and resources and motivation.
That also kind of leads us back into what you said was the first step or the first part of an engagement, which is actually the scope. And right. One of the most important things for people to learn is the value of scope, because as we often say on my own team, if you break scope, you might be actually breaking the law. So can you talk a little bit about the types of scope that you might have? What types of things are typically in scope or out of scope for a physical social engineering engagement?
Yeah. So scoping a physical engagement it's never cookie cutter. It's always going to be a little bit different, a little bit unusual. In the case of this blog post, the scope was pretty easily defined because the customer owned the entire building that we were attacking. They owned the grounds that the building were on. They owned all of the facilities of the building. All of the employees who worked there, with the exception of a security guard, were their own employees. So basically, within the perimeter of this facility, everything was in scope. It's much, much more common to have customers who share a building, who, they own one floor of a tall office building. They own one office on one floor of a building. They share resources with other companies who are nearby. And so as you are talking with your customer, as you're planning out your engagement, it's really, really important to drill down on that and to understand, okay, where are the boundaries of your property? Where are the boundaries of, what you have the ability to grant me authorization to test? It's great that, you stay in a building with a bunch of high security stuff downstairs, but if all that security on the ground floor belongs to a third party, I can't ethically and also legally, in some cases, lie to those people. I can't misrepresent myself to those people. I can't present false credentials to those people. That could come around to bite me in a legal context. And so, yeah, just really, really drilling down with the customer and understanding exactly where their borders and boundaries are is the first most important thing to do.
Also, when it comes to the social engineering engagements, the end result really does seem to need to be about education and when mm-hmm. and how you can explain to the client, here's how you get better. And if you are right. going to go compromise this third party that your client has nothing to do with, how can they fix that? How do you educate that? Mm-hmm. So, have you been in situations where either with teammates or maybe at other companies, or even just interacting with other people who say, yeah, when I go on this engagement, I'm going to get them. I'm going to get all the way in. I'm going to hack all the things and I'm going to get past everything. And you're like, hang on, let's talk about this a little bit. Do you have any kind of experiences with that as well?
Yeah. I've definitely worked on projects with people where, you know, I wasn't the one actually going on site. I may be reviewing the report afterwards. I'm providing QA or oversight. And I've definitely had to push back on some people's findings that are exactly that, you know, they've had findings of like, oh, well, yeah, the security guard at this building, you know, they've only got one security guard downstairs. So if, you know, I waited for that security guard to get up and go to the bathroom, then maybe I could, you know, I could get through. Okay, great. Like, that's how you got access to the building. Fantastic. What is your client who's renting half of an office on the sixth floor going to do about that? You know, are they going to pay for a second security guard to sit downstairs and protect the entire building? Probably not. Yeah, you pointed out something kind of cool and interesting, but it's not valuable to the customer, really. And you might get pushback from the customer about it, that, you know, these kinds of tests are not inexpensive. Typically, they're pouring a lot of resources into this kind of thing. They want to get some value out of it. And if those are the kinds of findings you're giving them, they might not come back and ask for a second test the next year.
Also, with social engineering, there is the social aspect, which often refers to human to human, interacting with people. And it seemed like in your blog post with that engagement that you did, that was a little bit of an issue. Can you talk about the lack of human interaction, the lack of on-site humans that you had to deal with?
Yeah. So this particular site, it was a high security data center where, you know, again, in talking with our customer and sort of hammering out our scope and what the expectations are, we learned that this is a very minimally staffed building. They only have two employees who work there full-time plus a third-party security guard. Other than those two, everyone who's coming in and out of the building are the data center's customers who are going to be considered out of scope. I can't go attack, you know, somebody who's a customer of this data center in order to gain access. That, you know, that violates that boundary of scope. So I really only have two people I can possibly interact with on a social level. Unfortunately, the entire facility was also surrounded by 8-foot-tall fences with barbed wire on top, with a gate that can only be opened and closed by the third-party security guard. The exterior doors to the buildings all have man traps and retina scanners and badge scanners. Yeah, we're not getting any face-to-face time with a person right away. A lot of jobs, a lot of these kinds of engagements, you can just walk in, you know, you can walk into the front door. There's going to be a receptionist. There's going to be an office. There's going to be somebody that you can talk to. In this instance, there is not.
So in that kind of environment where that is all locked down and there's two employees, so they obviously know each other and they know who's supposed to be coming and going, that really seems like that's going to be an instance where having your OSINT done, having all your investigation information done is super important, but also mm-hmm. coming up with a really good pretext is going to be important. Can you talk a little bit about what pretexts are and how you came up with a workable pretext for this engagement?
Yeah. Sure. So I mentioned a little bit earlier, yeah, the pretext is your cover story. That is, who am I? What am I doing here? Why do I need access to the things that I am trying to get access to? One of the things I kind of like to remind myself of, and that became very helpful to me in this engagement, is people don't build boxes that absolutely no one and nothing can get into. What would the point of that be? Why would you need that? There's always someone somewhere who can open the box, who can unlock the door, who can decrypt the file. There's always something. Social engineering is to me, the practice of figuring out who that person is and either becoming them or enlisting their help. And OSINT is the first part, is figuring out who is that person. Who is the person that can open that box? Who are the people who can get into this building? So in a more traditional engagement, that is one of the big questions that we would be trying to answer by doing OSINT is, okay, who are the employees who can come in and out? Who are the customers who can come in and out? Who are the contractors who can come in and out? Who are the people who just, who are the edge cases? Who are the corner cases? The people who once in a while, for weird reasons, have some reason to be there, but aren't well known, aren't going to be recognized by the people who work there, but still have a legitimate need to get into that building and who won't cross those lines of the scope that we're talking about. So again, in the sort of white box methodology of this test that we're employing, we basically just put those questions to our customer. We provided them, well, I should back up a little bit. We initially started with just doing our traditional OSINT with, you know, researching the company, researching what was available, what was there. What we found was the company provides tours of their data centers to prospective clients. So our initial thought was, oh, great. That's somebody who has access to the building, who doesn't need to be an employee. So maybe we pose as potential new customers. We try to schedule a tour. We try to get a couple of people into the building and then see if we can split off in somehow, see if we can get people to spread out, get a little bit of time sort of unsupervised in the building. So we kind of put together a rough idea of what our pretext was going to be, how we were going to accomplish that, and sent it over to our customer, to our contact, to say, you know, hey, does this sound reasonable? And the contact sent back an email saying, that sounds like a good idea, but I personally know the salesperson that you would get assigned to in this particular region. And I believe the quote was, the likelihood of your detainment or injury would be high, and we wouldn't necessarily be able to intervene. So again, that goes back to another point when planning any sort of social engineering engagement is communicate with your customer. Just because you're doing what feels like cool ninja spy stuff doesn't mean you have to be like an actual secret agent who's keeping everything secret. Talk to your customers, get approval, get sign off. Turns out this particular salesperson takes physical security very, very, very seriously and had a history of bringing firearms into the data center. And apparently they kept telling the salesperson he was not allowed to do that. And he kept doing it anyway. They finally compromised and said, okay, knives and zip ties are all right. Anyways, that's way above my pay grade. That is not the kind of thing that I am here to do or to deal with. So at this point, we had already used up a chunk of our time for OSINT preparation. So that was when we really transitioned to that more white box style test of like, okay, look, we need to come up with something. We need to come up with something fast. We don't have a lot of the information that we need. So basically, I have kind of a list of different things that I am looking for when I'm doing OSINT. Certainly not comprehensive, but it's a decent list of things. And I basically just sent that list to the customer and said, look, this is the kind of stuff that if I were a, you know, APT style person, this is what I would be looking for. This is the kind of stuff I would be sitting outside your building with a telephoto lens for months at a time trying to figure out. Answer as many of these as you feel is comfortable, is reasonable. It sort of matches your security model or your threat models. And the customer did that. And so one of the big things that we look for is contractors, is, you know, do they have third-party security service? Do they have commissary? Do they have housekeeping? You know, who are all the people that can come in and out? They didn't have any of those, but they do have pest control. And the customer provided the name of the pest control company that they use. Big national brand, not going to say what it is, but not hard to guess. Yeah, so looking through the details of that, one of our testers who was with us as we were going through that note just went, hey, I actually hired them last week to come do some work at my house. I actually still have all of the emails that we had for that. And that was kind of when the light went off for us. So like, hey, this is potentially an in for us.
Do you have a typical toolbox that you use on this, or is it always going to be flexible based on the pretext? Does the pretext drive the toolbox? Do you have typical things that you like to bring?
The pretext drives the toolbox, definitely. For me, the toolbox is usually pretty light. I usually carry a backpack with, you know, my laptop, a couple of cables, connectors, dongles, that kind of thing. It depends on the customer, on what their, you know, needs, wants, expectations are. I don't typically carry a huge amount of equipment, sometimes under door tools, other kinds of bypass equipment like that. We don't do a lot of lock picking when we're on site. Typically that is, you know, potentially destructive. Nobody wants to find out they paid someone to ruin their fancy door locks. And I'm not that great at lock picking anyway. I know how. Takes too long. I'd much rather just ask someone to open the door for me.
You might as well ask if, you know, there is somebody there that can open the box for you. Just say, can you open this for me?
Right. You know, that's a big part of what draws me to social engineering in the first place, is just how incredibly efficient it is. You know, you go to conferences and you sit and listen to somebody talk about how they spent 8 months reverse engineering some firewall and found out that on the 8 millionth time they try this one packet, some bit flip somewhere. And that's incredible. Like, that is really, really impressive work. But I can just call somebody and ask them what their password is, and I now have root access to that device that you flipped a bit in. So, you know, I'm lazy. I'm the laziest hacker.
And while it comes to lock picking, while these places might not have the most expensive, most high-tech locks, but they're also certainly not going to be just a one-pin lock where right. an extremely experienced person could, you know, pick that within seconds. I would think that a lot of these locks, even for the most experienced person, at a minimum, it's still going to take them 30 to 45 seconds. And if you're crouched down in front of a lock for 30 to 45 seconds and somebody's watching on camera or happens to look down the hallway, that looks a little bit curious. So why not? Just can you open this door for me? I need to get in for whatever good reason that you've come up with.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, and again, is saying I was able to pick your lock even a valuable finding for your customer in the first place? Was that what they were asking you to do? Or were they asking you to test if their employees are following policies and procedures? Again, yeah, if they're concerned about policies and procedures and you're talking to them about four pin locks and ABIS versus master lock, yeah, you're kind of missing the point.
So for this engagement, what was in your toolbox? How far did you go to be pest control? What types of things did you go get and do and present?
Honestly, as we were doing it, I thought that this was insane and this was never going to work. But by the time we got it all pulled together, actually looked pretty legit. First thing, I mean, it's one of the oldest tricks in the book, but it's my favorite. Go get a shirt with a logo printed on it. They're not hard to make. It's almost every reasonable sized town has a shop that will do it for you if you just pay them money. People will trust a shirt with a logo on it more than whatever it is you have to say to them a shocking amount of time. So first thing I did, went out, got a couple of shirts with the pest control logo on it. Next, we went and got a, this particular pest control company tends to drive around in one very specific type of vehicle with some very sort of recognizable branding. So we went and got a, basically a sting, cling stick die cut logo of their logo made, rented that type of vehicle, basically, reached out to the company. When we finally got to the airport to pick up the car, they, you know, surprise upgraded us to like a Humvee or something that would not have worked. I had to go back and like really be like, no, look, I need this specific vehicle, which thankfully they were able to do. Otherwise, who knows what would have happened. But yeah, once we were on site, we then went to the Home Depot, just the local Home Depot, rented a ladder, bought a couple of like actual tool bags, bought a couple of rat traps, some flashlights, you know, just like we didn't have enough time to do an enormous amount of OSINT on this. But, you know, that's one of the things about social engineering that I've been experiencing a lot lately is a little bit of preparation goes a long way, especially when it comes to the visuals. As long as you have most of the visual cues, not very many people are going to look at you and go, hey, this one tiny detail is wrong. Even if they notice it's wrong, they're just going to assume that their understanding is flawed. Honestly, it just for me and my own personal joy, when I go on site, I carry my backpack, my like regular work backpack with the big NetSpy logo embroidered on it, just because I want somebody someday to notice that and go, huh, NetSpy, I wonder what that is. He said he's from this other company, and then go Google who we are and catch me. Hasn't happened yet. Nobody's even come close. Anyway, so yeah, back to your question. I just kind of went off on a bit there.
It really does seem like you can get into anywhere if you have a ladder and a clipboard.
Yeah. Yeah. In this case, we had a ladder and a little tool bag, but yeah, that was enough.
One of the other things that I noticed in your blog post was that you were able to get all the way, not just past the fencing, not just inside the building, but you were also able to get all the way into the data center floor doing something that I think you referred to as winter pest proofing. Which yeah. I think you even mentioned, like, you don't even know what that is. But
yeah, no, I made that up on the spot. No idea what.
Which is another thing that you're probably hoping, please call me out on this. I'm like, I have no idea what it is. I want you to say there's no such thing as that. So stop, go away. You can't come any further. But
right.
Did you just say like, okay, I need to go into this corner. I need to go into this corner. I need to go in that room over there that you kind of figured out was the data center so that you could do your work and they just let you in?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so we let them know that, backing up a little bit, I guess, in order to get into the building, in order to actually make all of this happen, we had to do a little bit of pre-work, a little bit of kind of greasing the wheels a little bit. So what we did was we purchased a lookalike domain to this customer. You know, it's a domain that's just one letter off, set up email servers, and we took those emails that my coworker had from when they had hired this pest control company, modified them to, you know, change the dates, the times, the addresses, the names on it and everything, and then forwarded it to an email address at this new domain that we had set up, and then forwarded that email to one of the two people who worked in the data center, whose email addresses we had from the OSINT worksheet that we had asked the customer for. So the customer had provided the names and email addresses of these two people who worked there for us. So we pretended to be one of those two people, sent an email to the second of those two people, basically forwarded this fraudulent appointment reminder and just said, hey, pest control people are going to be here on Friday. They need to do, yeah, winter pest proofing. Let them know, hey, this is, you know, it took us a long time to get this on their schedule. Please let them in, you know, add a little bit of urgency to that, add a little bit of it, of stuff, and sent the email. Again, these are two people who know each other, who work in the same building at the same time. This is kind of a high risk thing because it's going to be very easy for either of them to just, you know, for the guy who got the email to mention, oh, hey, yeah, I, you know, added the pest proofing to the schedule on Friday. And the other person go, what? But that didn't happen. We got an email back the next day from the guy. He said, okay, that was it. One word, okay. Which we were a little concerned that we were walking into a trap, to be honest. It was so, but, you know, whatever. Nothing ventured, nothing gained. And so, yeah, we showed up on site with our shirt, with our ladder, with our truck, with our little bag. The guy that we'd emailed met us outside the front door. We just said, hi, we're the pest control people. We're here for winter pest proofing. And he did ask, like, okay, so what is it that you're actually doing? And that was when I just told him, like, oh, yeah, we're just sort of inspecting the entire building. We're looking for any, you know, openings where pests might have possibly gotten in. Looking for openings. Yeah, trying very hard to keep a straight face. But yeah, the guy, he said, okay, great. And he swiped his badge on the little badge reader. He scanned his eyeballs on the eyeball reader, let us walk into the man trap with him. He waved at the security guard through the window. The security guard opened the second door and we were in. So yeah, we then just told this guy, okay, we just need to see the whole building top to bottom. We're just gonna, you know, make sure that no pests can get in here. And he walked around with us through the entire building. We basically just grabbed one wall and followed it all the way around. We were not only on the data center floor, but we were also in the like power center rooms, the maintenance rooms. Basically went through the entire building, setting up my ladder. I was able to get up into the floor, into the ceiling tiles above the data center. There was a bunch of different Ethernet cables and things running around up in there that were not secured. So there was a customer in the data center while we were there who was working on something. I was able to just stand on my ladder 6 feet behind him and get photos of, you know, his screen, of his keyboard, of what he was doing. The guy who was escorting us around the building, to his credit, I did ask if anyone's not familiar with a data center, typically it's a large open warehouse, and then there will be sort of cages, which act as the final layer of security around the actual computers. We did ask if we could get into the cages, you know, to check the ceilings up in there. And the guy drew the line there. He was definitely like, nope, I'm sorry. In order to go into, there's a whole, you have to do background checks. You have to do the whole thing. We said, okay, great. We didn't push too much harder on that. So he did a good job there. But yeah, we basically walked around the entire building, got photos of everything. Yeah, had hands on cables. We actually went into the security guard's office, and we were up in the ceiling tiles above him as well. You know, I was up there pretending to do something, but I was really just had, you know, my camera out and was just taking photos of everything the whole time.
And you also earlier mentioned that one of the fears that you had walking in, like, are we walking into a trap? Uh-huh. If you had been walking into a trap, I'm guessing you had a permission letter with you.
Yes. Yes. Always.
What is the permission letter and what's the value with that?
Yeah. So sometimes called the get out of jail free letter. This is basically just a signed letter from our contact at the customer, which says, this is a test. These people are testers. They are in fact allowed to be here. Do not throw these people into jail. You know, gives a phone number, email address, so that if you get caught, you can just present that letter and walk away without having to spend a night in prison. That letter is kind of the difference between performing a job and committing a crime.
And not necessarily just in this engagement, but in all the engagements that you've ever done, how far are you willing to push against somebody who they, you know, their spidey senses are going off and they're kind of figuring out like something's not right here, and they're pushing back on you. They're giving you a hard time and maybe even trying to get you away and get you out. How far will you push before you pull out that permission letter and be like, no, this was just a test. I'm trying to get through here.
Yeah. It depends a little bit on the circumstances and the situation. I'm not a big fan of causing any sort of, you know, emotional turmoil for the people that I'm performing testing against. So, you know, confronting somebody who is in a place that they are not supposed to be is not an easy thing for most people to do. It can be very stressful. It can, you know, really sort of it can really like raise the adrenaline levels. And so if I see that with the person who's interacting with me, if they are really nervous, if they are really scared, if they are really angry, I will pull that letter out pretty quick. I'm not gonna force somebody to go through stuff. In other cases, when somebody is, you know, just doing their job, being polite, doing everything that they think they should be, I will push a little bit further. I will, you know, really push until I get a very firm, solid, no, you can't be here. You need to leave. This is not okay. And at that point, I will de-escalate.
And have you or would you ever push it so far that you actually get physically removed, where maybe somebody grabs you by the arm and be like, you have to go now?
I have pulled out the letter just before that point on some tests. Nobody has ever felt like they needed to physically put their hands on me and remove me from a building. But yeah, if I saw that coming, I would definitely pause that. I would definitely stop the test before then.
One of the things that we often hear when it comes to social engineering is that people are the weakest link. People are dumb. People are the problem. But in your blog post, one of the things that I really liked that you had in there is that it's often a question of people versus policy. And I think specifically in this engagement, you found that the problem was not the people, that it was the policy, and that the problem is often more about systemic issues. It's more about training. It's about awareness, compliance. What is kind of your experience of the people are really dumb, which I disagree with, versus they just either the policy is bad or the training has been bad?
Yeah, I have not yet been on an engagement where I felt like the person I was talking to was the problem. You know, I don't believe I've ever encountered like true just, you know, negligent incompetence. And I've never encountered malicious, you know, oh, I hate this company, you come do it, you just come on in and do whatever you want. It's that kind of thing, I think, is a lot rarer than we sometimes believe. What I have encountered is a lot of people who are doing their best and trying their hardest, but they just don't know what to do. They don't know how to respond to the situation that they have suddenly found themselves in. In the case of this data center, you know, going back through the findings after what happened and sort of, again, talking to the customer and figuring out what the policies and procedures are, we found this guy, you know, this poor guy who led us into the building and walked around with us the whole time, he hadn't actually violated any of the company policies. He had received the only thing that he really didn't quite catch was that this email that he received was one letter off from his boss's email. I mean, is that, you know, that's not a major failure on that person's part. That is not a problem with that person. That's a problem that can be solved with technology. You know, that is, you know, email filtering, spam filtering, putting those big banners that say, this is not from one of your coworkers on emails from external sources. Those kinds of things need to be in place to protect against that sort of thing. So aside from that one little thing that he missed, this guy got an email from a coworker letting him know about something that was going to happen at his workspace. He just showed up and was being as helpful as he could. When we asked him to explicitly violate the policy of allowing us into that cage, he refused. He had authorization from his coworker to allow us to be in there. He thought he didn't actually do anything wrong. There was a problem with their policy that they didn't have a good policy in place for vendor visits. You know, for a site like that, that is that level of high security, if you've got retina scanners and door, you know, man traps and armed security guards on, you know, 24/7 security, you should be checking the ID of everyone who comes in your doors. You know, if a vendor is going to be coming in, you need to be getting the names of the actual technicians who are going to arrive in advance. You need to be checking their IDs against that, you know, against that information. And if they don't match, you need to not be letting them in. But they didn't have a policy to cover that. And so we were able to exploit it.
And another thing that you wrote that he did well was that a typical trick that people like you like to do is when you outnumber the guard is to try to separate. Like one guard can't always be watching two people. But I think you wrote in there that the guard was cognizant of that and was not letting you separate.
Yeah, absolutely. Once we were inside the data center, there were two of us, two testers who came in. And once we were inside, we immediately tried to split up. And he absolutely was like, nope, we've all got to stay together. So we stayed together for a few minutes. Eventually, one of my partner who was with me said that they needed to use the bathroom and just said, oh, yeah, I'll just go run out. And he was like, nope. He made me pack up my ladder and all three of us walked out of the data center together and then walked back in together. He did a lot of things right.
And that's always great to hear. And when we talk about all of these things that we've probably talked about for the last 45 minutes or so, some people will ask me, like, why are you teaching people how to do bad things? And it's like, yes, we are doing social engineering. We're hired to do it. We're contracted to do it. We're the good guys to do it, but we are acting like bad guys. So why are we teaching people, like through this podcast, all these different steps that bad people could potentially do? So one of the questions that I like to ask at this point is, what are some of the ways that, not even necessarily in this test, what tips would you give that are typically good for stopping a physical social engineer? What are some of the typical things that you see that are either the policy violations or the lack of training that somebody might actually let you do? And what are the good ways to stop you?
You know, the first thing is, you know, technology is bypassable, but it is your friend. It is going to be more consistent than people. So anytime you can replace a human policy with a technical control that you trust, I advocate for that. It's like I said, it's going to be a lot harder for me to pick a lock than it is for me to ask someone to hold the door open for me. But when you do start getting into the like actual people, I think it kind of comes down to culture as well. I think people need to feel empowered to ask questions. They need to feel like it's okay to walk up to a stranger in your building and say, hi, I've never seen you before. Who are you? Why are you here? And even if that person is the CEO of the company, that they're not going to be made to feel awkward about that. Like I said, that can be really stressful and difficult for some people to, you know, approach someone that they don't know and start kind of questioning them about who they are and what their, you know, what their motivations are or what their reason is for being there. But that is something that culturally needs to exist within your organization. And I think people need training on how to do that in a way that is, you know, not confrontational, not judgmental, not, you know, not going to seem rude, because 99% of the time, if somebody's walking around in your building, they have a legitimate reason to be there. But you still need to have those skills and that confidence just to be able to double check, trust, but verify, just make sure.
What recommendations would you give for somebody who wants to learn to do the types of things that you do? Somebody wants to be a social engineer. Like I'm guessing that you would not recommend that somebody just go practice by trying to walk into a building that they're not supposed to be in. So if you can't practice that way, how can people learn to do these types of things?
So, I mean, a lot of great advice has been given out there about ways that you can practice. I'm a big fan of I'm sure it's somebody who's been on your podcast before, but who gave the advice of go out in public and practice approaching a stranger, asking them for, or telling them a lie, and then asking them for a favor. Just do that over and over and over again with as many people as you can. And it can be very, very simple. It can be really easy. Hi, I'm really sorry to bother you. My phone is dead. Do you know how to get to Walgreens from here? It can be that quick. It can be that easy. Just do that until and really watch the other person. Watch the different ways that you can approach a person and the different ways that a person responds to a stranger walking up to them. Watch their body language. Watch the way that they react. You know, if you do that a couple of times and people like look at you and go, ew, creep, get away from me. Like, why are you bothering me? That's great. that is great. You have learned, you know, you can use that to learn and adjust your, you know, your technique to where you get to, you start to get more of a feel of how to approach strangers, how to talk to people, you know, what is it that I'm doing with my voice or with my body that is cluing them in that you, that there's something off about what you're doing. I'm a big fan of that. The other advice that I would give that I haven't heard as much as you sort of, you know, learn these skills and build up and get closer to doing this, learn to take care of your own mental health. This kind of work, especially the first couple of times you do it, can be extremely stressful. It's not a natural thing for most of us to lie and to deceive. And even if we're doing it for, you know, what we know intellectually are not altruistic purposes, but, you know, legal good purposes, it can take a toll on you. And I have definitely taken people out with me on their first, second times doing this, and they're really excited about it. And they're really engaged and they're really into it. And they do it once or twice and they go, never again. I'm never doing that. I hate this. This is not for me. And it's because of that stress and that anxiety. And they don't have the tools to be able to, you know, process those emotions and work through them and, you know, walk away from this feeling like they did a good job today. So yeah, learn to take care of yourself, of your own mental health. Learn how to process anxiety, learn how to process fear, learn how to control those emotions in the moment and then deal with them afterwards, because they can get you.
So if you want to read the blog post that we've been referring to, you can find that on the netspy.com site. Again, the title of the blog post is Not Your Average Bug Bounty, How an Email, a Shirt, and a Sticker Compromised a High Security Data Center. And I'll also put a link to it in the notes. I just want to say thank you so much, Dallin McClellan, for joining us on the Larry Podcast.
Hey, thank you so much. It was a pleasure.